morning of reconvening the hearing. And we've had your submissions, but I have to say I haven't even opened them, I'm afraid.
Right. Well, I will go through them now. I wonder, and I appreciate that they weren't filed in much time.
I had a private commitment last night, so I had no chance to read them at all.
Given they are quite long, would you like me to...
Could you just pick out the high points, probably?
Yeah, I can do that. Probably would have been, it might be more efficient to be able to take time to read them. But the notice of the introductory section of the law, which is repetition of what they presented at previous hearings, but given we've got a different type of panel, I just went over again the issues of really addressed from paragraph, as I summarised it. Summarise the paragraph 12 and paragraph 14. The outstanding issues between Council, RPL and QAC. And then I then go on to address the relevant issues, or the issues that specifically make the rise from the legal matters from paragraph. So I can start to go through from there if you like, or perhaps you might like to read them.
Well, if we're looking at
paragraph 43.
Maybe if you just summarise them as we went through it.
And okay, sure.
I will certainly read them in full later.
So in this section I address the scope to amend the provision as recommended by Mr. Kyle. And I note that Ms. Holden has identified a number of potential scope issues with a number of reviewed by Mr. Kyle. And I go through those in these paragraphs, and in my submission, there aren't any scope issues. QAC's original submission was very broadly framed, and in my submission, you need to read that in around. It had the text which set out the background and in general what QAC was trying to achieve, and the appendix was specifically. But the relief was framed in a way such that you want to read both of those to ascertain what QAC is seeking and to either provide the scope for it, for the amendments that you can make. The relief included the general catch-all phrase that the sufficient points identified in the submission should be accepted. For the proposed plan amended in similar or such other way, it may be appropriate to address those sufficient points and any consequential changes, amendments or decisions required to address the matters raised. So, in my submission, QAC's submission is very broad and provides scope for most of the amendments that Mr. Kyle is recommending. And some of the provisions he's recommending require a bit. Sort of a closer look as to whether there is scope, and I've undertaken that in my legal submission. And RPL's submission actually provides scope for some of the amendments as well. RPL is seeking a retention of, effectively a retention of the status quo of the operative plan provisions, and so your range of operative plan provisions which is proposed, and within that there's quality of latitude and in relation to. For visitor accommodation, RPL's position is prohibited, QAC's position is notified, plan is permitted, so that's pretty much as broad as you can get in terms of scope. change issue direction and match the position of in the visitor accommodation rule and zone. It is proposed that an angle design level be achieved for 40 CBLDM, and that's better to be either by building the hotel building in accordance with the construction method stated in the PEP 13, or otherwise to being made an acoustic certificate saying that that's been appropriate with the 40 CBLDM until that level will be achieved. And Mr. Hunt has said that the PEP 13 construction method might ensure that you achieve 40. Inside, Mr. Davies to you today will be that he agrees with that, and so subsequently you need to make a change to the visitor accommodation rule. Dr. Charles has recommended you do that by simply deleting the reference to Appendix 13, which means to the only way you can achieve or demonstrate you've achieved an indoor design standard of 40 CBLDN is by providing acoustic effects of council. And he has suggested that RPL's, like a piece of suggested that RPL's submission may provide scope for that. RPL says it doesn't because it's seeking prohibition, so you can't possibly derive scope from a submission that for anything that's enabling in terms of VA, but I disagree with that. I say by removing the, taking out the Appendix 13 reference, the rule is becoming more restrictive. It means you only have only one way in which you can demonstrate compliance as opposed to two. It is by providing an acoustic certificate to the council. And so in terms of the spectrum and scope, you've got to have it on one and submit it on the other. I say by taking out the reference to Appendix 13, more restrictive, more towards prohibitive, and RPL's permission provides scope for that relation. In terms of the noise, and I should say I don't actually address the Appendix 13 issue in my written submission, and I also don't address the noise limit issue, the maximum noise limit, which I will address it now to you verbally. As you'll be aware, there's an issue as to what the noise limit should be in the airport mixed use zone. RPL says they are too permissive, and that should be consistent with the surrounding zone, in particular the rural zone. Mr. Kyle will present a table to you today which compares the operative provisions of the airport zone and zones around the airport and the proposed provisions, and that will show that what is being sought in the airport mixed use zone is not inconsistent with the noise limits and surrounding zones.
How are the operative provisions relevant?
Because RPL has sought retention of the operative provisions for the RPD. So, RPL sought retention of the operative provisions, and because the Franklin Black Seas and Remarkable Park Zones aren't being addressed in the official plan review. And so, considering what's happening in the surrounding environment, which is RPL's argument, and what QAD is proposing is inconsistent, you need to look at those officers.
So you're saying it's a scope issue?
No, I haven't given the quite got the yet. So Mr. Sargent given it to you today in the revised provision that he handed out, he proposed a noise limit rule, which is 210.5.6.1, and he proposed daytime noise limit of 50 dB LAEQ and nighttime noise limits of 40 dB LAEQ and 70 and 70 on that. And those are the operative of other rural zone noise limits. And there is no scope for those noise limits because, in speaking to the trial table, the operative airport zone noise limits are actually 55 and 45, not 50 and 40. So that's your starting point, because that's what RPL is seeking. The notified provisions for the airport zone carry over the operative provisions, but then the notified provisions of the chapter 36 are actually inconsistent with the notified provisions of the chapter and more enabling. So it goes into the operative provisions and the more enabling provisions, but it's not the rural zoning provisions, which is what RPL is seeking. So there's no scope for the more restrictive provisions that RPL has proposed.
So the point is that you consider it's a scope issue that doesn't remove the inconsistent argument, does it?
Well, it will lift a file when you send it.
So that's fine.
So what I'm saying is, what RPL is seeking in the diligence provision is not correct for that. As soon as the inconsistency, that's a potential issue, and Mr. Carver is just saying.
Well, and when Mr. Carver's doing that, he can address the low density residential as well, because the rural zone is only one of the zones.
That's right. That's right, but as I say, you don't have scope to, even though the rules of the low density residential zones are effectively the same, zones are effectively the same as the rural zone, or if you don't have scope.
But it is within our ability, in our report, if we consider it to be inconsistent, to say so, isn't it?
Yes.
So it is important that we consider the evidence and come to some conclusion as to whether it is inconsistent or not.
Yes, absolutely.
And if it is, and whether the difference is justified.
Yes, that's right. Right. And as I say, Mr. Carver is addressing on that. Okay. And those are the questions there. I think the other scope issues I can probably just leave you to read my legal submissions. I have taken a fairly liberal view in terms of scope, but I consider that that's appropriate in this process. Start getting the right outcome and the right plan, and the legal principles of scope support that approach. I also note that a number of the changes that Mr. Carlisle recommends are foremost substance, and so those places in it and it is an issue for those, and Ms. Holden considers some of those are substantial changes and am I submitting or not, and we'll see. The provisions I'm talking about there when you read my legal submissions is, for example, relocating policies and including things in the definition of report-related activities, which were actually permitted activities in the notified plan and the notified zone. So I'm now just visitor accommodation, and that's paragraph 56 of my legal submissions, and I'll perhaps read those out, and I will make a couple of amendments as I go along, in light of the evidence that Mr. Day will present to you today. So paragraph 56, the definition of airport-related activity in the plan is notified, includes visitor accommodation associated with the needs of airport passengers, visitors and employees, and or aircraft movements and businesses. The proposed plan as notified proposes that airport-related activities be permitted, and so therefore it's proposed that visitor accommodation is permitted. We are associated with the names of airport passengers and so forth. The section 42A, reporting officer Ms. Holden correctly identified that establishing visitor accommodation within close proximity to an airport has become an acceptable and subsidiary activity to airport operations around the country, but note that potential reverse sensitivity and adverse effects need to be appropriately mitigated. Ms. Holden considered this is achieved by notified standards 17.581, which is the internal noise rules, and she's also recommended that there be a restriction on the provision of outdoor amenity areas, both of which report by so QAC filed a submission in support of general support of the proposed zone, and by application that included the provision for visitor accommodation. Since then, QAC has sought further advice from Marshall Day Acoustics as to the circumstances in which visitor accommodation can be considered appropriate at an airport, and more particularly within the airport's noise boundaries, so as not to adversely affect people's immunity and well-being, or to give rise to potential reverse sensitivity effects. QAC has sought such advice because much of the proposed airport mixed use zone is located within the north boundary of the airport. Consistent with Marsha Day's November 2014 report, and that's the report that was formed part of the Section 32 evaluation, Mr. Day has recommended to QAC that any such visitor accommodation should be limited to a maximum of 2 nights a day and should not provide any outdoor amenity areas, for example, patios and balconies, and should be subject to a requirement that the building be designed to achieve an indoor sun standards of 40 dB LG in an all critical distant environment. QAC generally accepts these recommendations, but for the 2 night maximum stay. As explained by Mr. Trigicha, QAC considers a 3 night maximum stay is more appropriate as it enables long weekend travellers to be accommodated for and will give other travellers more flexibility in the event your flight is delayed and an additional night stay in Queensland is required, for example. Mr. Trigicha explains that a 3 night maximum stay is also required so cater for the weekend visitor from Australia, noting that there is a growing market for such travellers with the recent introduction of Eden flights. Mr. Trigicha also explains, considers a 3 night maximum stay is required in order for visitor accommodation within the airport zone to be more commercially viable. Based on Mr. Day's and Mr. Trigicha's evidence, Mr. Carr recommends the inclusion of 2 additional development standards relating to visitor accommodation, which address the maximum duration of any stay, which is 3 nights, and the provision of outdoor amenity areas, which is none. If the standard is not met, non-compliant activity status will be triggered. Mr. Day's evidence is that with the restrictions he recommends embedded in the rules that apply to the airport zone, short stay visitor accommodation, as is proposed to be enabled, is, and I'll just wish to formally amend this, the latter part of the sentence, which is paragraph 35. So, short stay visitor accommodation, as is proposed to be enabled within the zone, is, strike out the remaining words of that sentence and replace it with the following, significantly less noise sensitive than long stay and residential activity and will not give rise to reverse sensitivity effects. And that is because the short duration of stay means guests are less likely to be annoyed and complain about aircraft noise. The short duration of the stay means that guests are not holidaying in the zone as such, but rather choose to stay at the airport hotel because of its convenient location in relation to the airport. Adverse effects on immunity and well-being are addressed by the restriction on the provision of outdoor amenity areas and the requirement for an indoor design boundaries of 40 dB LGU to be achieved in critical lift environment of hotel building. And I just wish to add a further reason as to why Mr. Day considers short stay visitor accommodation appropriate. And that is because there was an expectation, what reasonably anticipated, guests would reasonably anticipate that they will see aircraft noise because of the hotel's location next to an airport. Mr. Day's evidence is that short stay visitor accommodation can be contrasted with longer stay or long term visitor accommodation, which serves a different purpose and caters to different guests. QAC is very mindful of its general approach to the establishment of new SMs in the airport's noise boundaries, both through the proposed plan and previous planning processes. However, Mr. Day's evidence is that short stay visitor accommodation, as it's proposed, is not, and I want to strike out the word an SM and replace it with, is not as noise sensitive as other SMs and will not give rise to reverse sensitivity effects, and need not be subject to the same restrictions as other SM within the noise boundaries. On this basis, QAC supports the provision of visitor accommodation within the airport zone, noting that provision of visitor accommodation for transiting passengers and short-term visitors is now commonplace at major airports, and there is generally a demand for it at Queensland Airport. And Mr. Hedges' evidence it's nice that further. The other opposes the proposal to enable visitor accommodation within the eastern zone. And it does so on the following waterfront, which I paraphrase. Firstly, that it's inconsistent with the Otago Regional Policy Statement, PC19 and PC35 and the rest of the proposed plan, and also the New Zealand Noise Standard. Secondly, that it's contrary to QAC's own arguments in previous proceedings where it is strivingly opposed, which the establishment of new Assam within the airport's noise boundaries. Thirdly, RPL reports that the adverse effects are not be avoidable mitigated, in particular that limiting the duration of visitor accommodation is not effective for this mitigation. Fourthly, that the acoustic insulation standards contained in the Appendix 13 of the operative plan and replicated in Table 4 of Chapter 36 of the proposed plan will not ensure an appropriate indoor sound level, and the Appendix is therefore an inadequate design standard for visitor accommodation located within the ANZ. And fifthly, RPL reports that reasonable alternatives such as allowing visitor accommodation in the OCB and other zones around the airport, such as from Marketable's Park Zone or Franklin Flats B Zone, and both of which RPL owns land, have not been adequately considered. And I now go on to address those arguments. In the next paragraph, I address the standard and what it does. I wonder if I need to go over that given you.
We don't become very familiar with the standard. Yes.
QAC does not agree with or accept RPL's criticism that enabling visitor accommodations in the airport zone is inconsistent with the standard and the processes and statutory planning documents that rely on the refer to it. That's the approach QAC is taking. Previous procedures I'm referring to there. As already noted, this is today's evidence is that with appropriate restrictions in place in respect of duration of stay, provision of outdoor space and acoustic insulation of buildings, short-stay visitor accommodation is proposed to be enabled within the zone is, I just mean my words, is a much less noise-sensitive use than other assets. As such, enabling short-stay visitor accommodation within the airport zone as is proposed will not give rise to adverse amenity effects for guests of the accommodation, nor to potential adverse sensitivity effects. Accordingly, there is no inconsistency with the standard or the position taken by the proceedings or in the proposed plan proceedings. Similarly, there is no inconsistency with the regional policy statement because potential adverse sensitivity effects will be avoided. Mr. Hunt states that Marshall Dave's November 2014 report that Section 32A fails to address the recommendations of the noise standards which prohibits noise-sensitive developments such as visitor accommodation on sites located in the A and B. He has, however, misstated the standards, as I have noted in writing previously. The standard recommends that new residential schools, hospitals and other noise-sensitive uses are prohibited in the airport boundary, but it does not expressly reference visitor accommodation. And Mr. Day's evidence is that long-stay visitor accommodation is a noise use, but short stay, such as proposed, is not. And Mr. Day will address that further today. The adverse issue raised by RPL is that the adverse effects of enabling short stay visitor accommodation within the AAB can't be avoided or mitigated sufficiently. In this regard, Mr. Hunt's evidence is that restricting the duration of stay will not achieve any mitigation or reduction of effects. Mr. Hunt's logic by his logic, every unit that's exposed to aircraft noise for 365 days of the year will experience the same average steps as a hotel guest who experiences it for one or two nights. In my position, that's supportable. And again, this day will address that for today. The next section I address the Appendix 13 requirements. Mr. Hunt says we're not ensure 40 dB unit is achieved where a hotel is located within the A and B and I should perhaps double go through that. Appendix 1st is paragraph 95. Appendix 13 of the Oxford Plan was introduced by PC35 and was drafted to address the construction of new dwellings and buildings and that, including alterations in addition to existing buildings that will in the future, that means 2037, which was the planning horizon for PC35, be exposed to noise levels of up to 68 dB. And 68 would be the noisiest location inside the A&B where a dwelling or an asset could potentially be constructed, and that's the result of the zoning restrictions. And Appendix 13 is the same as Table 4 of Chapter 37 of the Mr. Dable explained today that noise measurements inside dwellings near Auckland and Wellington Airport have shown that an indoor sound level of 40 dB can be achieved by the construction method stated in Appendix 13. Where external aircraft noise levels are less than 68 dB. It is acknowledged, however, that in this case, an airport hotel could be established in the airport zone in a location where external noise levels are greater than 68, meaning that the construction method stated in Appendix 13 may not be adequate to ensure an appropriate indoor noise level is achieved. So in line with this, Mr. Kyle recommended amendments to the proposed development standard, which ensures 40 dB can be achieved, and that is, as I've previously noted, so the removal of that reference to Appendix 13. So the only way you can demonstrate and you can assure you achieve the appropriate that the 40 dB unit into it, noise level twice as big and present to the council. Note that Dr. Child recommends the same approach that he's seeking for my unsure about scope, and I've already addressed you on that. On how to self-form early design the activity status building. RPR purports there has been no proper consideration of the integration of the proposed expansion of the airport zone with the joining zone, and it also supports that amenity and early design impacts have been grossly understated or not addressed at all. RPR's arguments are very similar to those that presented in the designation hearing when opposing QAC's NOI to modify designation 2. For the designation of the building, sorry, the building height limits and setbacks sought via QAC's NOI for that designation are the same as those that are proposed to apply from the airport zone. As explained by Mr. Kyle at the designation hearing, the nature and scale of the proposed activities, including building heights and setbacks, falls under the range of outcomes enabled and anticipated to land in the adjacent commercial zones. Given this, the effects of the activities proposed to be enabled in the airport zone would be similar to and not incongruent with development and zones around the airport. And Mr. Kyle's attended the demonstrates this, and no doubt he will go through that with you today. Mr. Kyle's evidence is that the built form standards proposed to apply the airport zone will create great inconsistencies between the various land uses on practice plan, and will also provide the efficiencies of what is an increasingly limited land source at Queenstown Airport. As for RPL's allegation that the potential amenity and urban design impacts have been grossly understated or not addressed, QAC does not agree. The notified chapter contains numerous provisions, rules and development standards, which are focused on ensuring that appropriate built form outcomes are achieved. For example, the enablement of airport and airport-related activities in terms of design is proposed to be subject to compliance with detailed rules or development standards related to building design and location, landscaping, site coverage, setback and height, signage, lighting, clear, noise and transportation matters. other than the transport issue shortly. In addition to all other activities, so any activity that isn't an airport or an airport related activity, and which are prohibited, restricted discretionary resource consent is required, and the council discretion is restricted to broadband design, external appearance, site and services and structures, traffic, vehicle parking, site access and servicing, and that includes provision for an integrated transport system, as well as landscaping and as far proposed as the extent to which the activity benefits from the airport location. Furthermore, the notified chapter contains two very directive statements that QAC will adopt set best practices in design and design their principles at Queensland Airport, and that QAC shall prepare urban design guidelines for the zone that promote a built form and character which maintains the airport and its surrounds as an attractive gateway to the district. And QAC is committed to those. And I just, I'm too late for this here, and I acknowledge that notwithstanding the apparent mandatory language used in the non-regulatory methods, they are non-regulatory methods, and so QAC can't be compelled to prepare those food design guidelines. But as Mr. Vidger said, it will, and it's in the process of doing so. And it views food design as a very important element of what it offers of its business, and is committed to ensuring good outcomes in that regard. So,
if and when it did produce such urban design guidelines, would QAC seek to have them incorporated by reference in the district plan?
I haven't discussed that with QAC, but I suspect the answer is probably no.
So they would really have no force
no.
in a regulatory sense either?
No. And the reason it wouldn't be seen that they'd incorporated is that that removed flexibility to address matters as they, you know, as it's response matters as it needs to. But that's something that that may merit further discussions, whether that's appropriate on what you what you think about urban design. I think the point to note is that at present time that's still a work in progress and will be very much informed by the master plan work that QAC is currently undertaking. But you can rest assured that they are at the forefront of QAC's mind. So in light of what I've just said, in my submission RPL delegation that potential amenity and urban design impacts are grossly understated or not addressed as inaccurate. Notwithstanding this, Mr. Kyle has recommended in his either that some controls on buildings and those controls very comprehensive and they relate to matters of urban design and all those issues that RPL is raising. And he does so because that is consistent with the decision he took and what was recommended in the designation hearing.
So, the designation, of course, is only affects QAC.
That's right, but it would be odd to have a zone that is more enabling than the designation. So effectively buildings are effectively controlled activities under the designation because you need to go through an outline plan process. And what Mr. Kyle recommends at that hearing is that through that outline plan process, QAC see the condition of the designation which requires QAC to address certain urban design matters. So effectively a controlled activity consent where similar to where QAC introduced this matter. So in this case, he's now also proposing that buildings be controlled activities, bearing in mind they were permitted as notified, and that control relates to matters of urban design. And
I'll discuss that with Mr. Kyle when we get to that point.
And just in terms of scope, there is scope for that change by virtue of RPL's position, which the status quo is controlling to the office. And I also note that Mr. Sargent has recommended the same thing, that building is also being controlled activities, and he thinks that's quite important to address those in design issues that he's raised. And so Mr. Kyle and Mr. Sargent are in agreement. Now we need to extend of the vehicle mixed-use zone. RPL opposes the proposed extension of the zone and its extension from the upper boundaries to include all of QAC's designated land, so that's 120 hectares. So if I ask for it, it's also opposed to range of activities enabled on that land. Presumably RPL seeks the operative rural zoning for the plan to be retained. Mr. Kyle's evidence is that there is a clear misalignment between the operative rural zoning and much QAC's designated land and the activities actually occurring on the ground or enabled by the designation. Mr. Kyle's evidence is that many of the activities that would be expected to support a modern airport are discretionary, non-compliant or even prohibited activities. And given Queensland Airport is New Zealand's fourth busiest airport and its regionally significant infrastructure, this is both inappropriate and inefficient in my
submission. As a matter of law, isn't that the point of a designation? So that you don't have to worry about the underlying zoning? You get a designation and say that the underlying zoning is of relevance to the designating of the requiring authority, don't you?
Yes, that's correct. But of course, the designation only benefits the requiring authority. And I think as well that, and I agree with matter of law that's correct, but I think in practice, when you're dealing with, and that might be appropriate when you've got a substation, for example, in the rural zone, which occupies a small area, and it's appropriate that it's designated, that's sort of a blip in the overall context of what's going on around it, so it's appropriate to be dealt with by designation, but the underlying zoning remains rural. In this case, we're talking about 120 hectares of land, which is, it's an airport and it's going to continue to be an airport for the foreseeable future. And so it's appropriate that the zoning reflects that and that it provides for people other than QACs to undertake appropriate.
Yes, I can understand that in the vicinity of the terminal. I can't understand why immediately adjacent to the main runway, for instance, or between the runway and the proposed taxiway, why anything other than the designation needs to apply. Can you explain that, please?
Well, there's a little bit of land in the north, right, beyond the runway, which is...
So it's outside the designation?
I think probably more familiar with the boundaries of the designation of this campus. I think the question to be asked in this case is...
If we take your submission is that what an airport does, which is aircraft landing, taking off, taxiing, that's the essential characteristics of an airport, isn't it?
Well, no, that's not my submission. My submission is that modern airports actually comprise a whole range of things now in order to be viable. It's not just about runways and terminals anymore.
Yes.
In order to be viable, there are whole stuff.
But that's in certain areas. But if we take the fundamental point of any airport, no matter how big or small, that's the landing and taking off of aircraft, taxiing, standing, that sort of thing. Those matters are dealt with in the designation. It doesn't seem to me that it is relevant whether the underlying zoning provides for those things.
I think if you perhaps the approach a slightly different way, and maybe airport related activities don't need to be enabled within those operational areas because they're not going to be undertaken in any case. But nonetheless, the rural zone is the underlying rural zone is inappropriate. This environment is not rural, it's not surrounded by any rural development. It's highly developed and will continue to.
Should it be low density residential?
No. Why not? No, I don't, because it's adjacent to an industrial area.
Well, yes, but the industrial area is adjacent to residential areas too in other parts of the district.
Well,
that's not unusual. The point of the underlying zoning is for the zoning that would apply if the designation was removed. If the designation was removed, what does the district need more of? Residential land or industrial land? That's probably the question that has to be asked.
Well, and that's probably a question for Mr. Kyle, more of a planning matter. But in my submission, the rural zoning is clearly not appropriate. And the proposed airport zoning is the most appropriate of the options that are on the table, any options. It might not be a perfect zone for whatever reason, but it's the best zone and the cost of the options available. Because the low density residential zone, for example, in my submission, would be wholly inappropriate. Because it's located next to, as I say, heavy industrial, it's the area of the DNA of PC19, which directly adjoins the airport, provides the traditional industrial activity. So it would be wholly inappropriate to have a low density residential zone adjacent to that.
Joining the event centre, it might be appropriate.
Yes, but that wouldn't deal with the other part. So dividing QAC's land up so you aren't dividing part of it industrial and part of it low density residential. There's no evidence for that, and how that could possibly be the most appropriate.
Given your arguments on scope that you presented otherwise, isn't the range of scope between the operative underlying zoning and the airport mixed use zone, which is proposed, following your argument that within that range, any zone that had lesser effects than the airport mixed use zone but allowed more development than the rural zone must be within the scope, mustn't it, from your arguments?
Yes, I agree, but actually ascertaining what zoning that is, I think it's quite difficult. Because the effects of the different land use, the potential zones are quite different and quite difficult to compare. For example, if you've got a low density residential zone, you might say the effects are less in terms of traffic than if it was for the commercial zone. But then you've got reverse density effects on the industrial area next door to it. So it's not from a legal perspective, I agree and accept that there's some scope that's very broad. But actually, where that gets you, I think it's at least good.
The next question then, taking the fundamental principle of what an underlying zone is for, if the designation was removed, is the airport mixed use zone the most appropriate zoning to apply?
Well, QAC evidence and submission is yes.
And it would it need any alteration beyond what QAC are proposing at this point to be the most appropriate?
It's quite a broad question, but I would have to say based on the evidence and the considerations that have been undertaken to date, no, other than what Mr. Carr has recommended. But, there is some tinkering that probably could be undertaken to improve the zone, and no doubt you'll explore that with Mr. Kyle. But not altering it substantially.
Okay, thank you.
Paragraph 116 of my submissions, I note that the sergeant agrees with Mr. Kyle that the operative rural zoning is not subject. That's just really, that's. His evidence on that was that it's not consistent with what's happening on the surrounding land in rural zoning, and that the zoning therefore should be consistent with what's happening on the surrounding land.
Yeah, I looked at that carefully. And really, I was a little troubled by your submission on that point, because if you look at what Mr. Sargent actually said in his paragraph 720, he says midway through the paragraph, I accept that rural zoning may be inappropriate underlying zoning effort given the nature of the surrounding urban activity. But then he goes on to really qualify that.
Well, I think yesterday he
He didn't move from that when we were discussing the issue with him. So, you know, I really found that your reference there was, a little sharp, can I put it like that, because really the balance of his paragraph, and it goes on for some length, tells us about the position, and that's not referred to in your submission. You're claiming support, and I don't think that's
correct. It goes on for another sentence or so, and I've addressed elsewhere in my submission what he has to say, which is we're saying you need to consider whether other lands could satisfy
my point is
what sort of issue by the notified zoning. And earlier in the evidence, he said that could be the Franklin Flat Seagull, that was the Marshall Park land, for example, and I've addressed that.
Running out my point, paragraph 117. You submit RPL's opposition to expand the boundaries is not supported by its own evidence and is without merit. That's the point that troubled me. I don't think that's accurate at all. When I read Mr. Sargent's evidence, particularly on the point you've referenced, that's not what he's telling me.
I think when you read his evidence around, he is saying you need to have a bit more urban design control. You maybe need to reduce traffic. Economically, it stacks up, and it will result in benefits to the district all round. The rural zoning isn't appropriate, and the range of activities thought to be enabled is appropriate for Newport. I think when you read it around, that his evidence doesn't justify RPL submission.
Oh, that's a point for us ultimately.
Paragraph 118, I referenced the McElroy decision, which I addressed at length in the designation hearing, really just as a basis for justification for the range of activities that
Isn't that case really just about definition? In your submission, you refer to legitimacy has been confirmed by the Court of Appeal, but that case, as you reference in your own appendix, was really about determining the meaning to a particular word. Your own appendix at paragraph 3, you point out that the substance of that case was about that matter of interpretation. It wasn't about legitimising activity that can or should occur at airports. That's a different process.
Sorry, I was just momentarily wondering if I had actually
to correct
this
something
my submission here.
Well,
you've
got...
I thought I had corrected
a
piece of
text
today,
but... Well,
my colleague,
it's still
a different matter. Yeah, sorry. Can you...
My point is that you're placing reliance on the McElroy decision, and as I read that decision, it's not about confirming legitimacy of activities of airports, but it's about understanding the meaning to be attached to a word in a particular context.
Yes, I agree with that. But,
okay, well that's all I need. Yep. Okay.
Well, I would say there was a range of evidence about on what comprises the modern airport and what are legitimate airport activities and according to that evidence. Paragraph 120, I addressed the timing of the hearing of RPO's submission, opposing the extent of the airport zone. And I note that in the council's opening, it has suggested that that issue will be dealt with at the mapping hearings, which she's due to commence next year. And that's news to PRAC, and it's very concerned by that, and considers it would be wholly inefficient to take that approach.
Why is that news? Because it's been well known since I received from the minute in January of this year that submissions relating to the extent of zones on maps would generally be dealt with in the mapping hearings in 2017. I'm just wondering how come QAC can understand that.
It's not relevant to the Section 42 report at all. When RPL was released, there's no notation that it's been referred to a later hearing, as there has been a previous hearing, when that's the case. RPL raises the issue of the extent of the zoning in combination with all its other arguments, and they're intertwined in my submission. You can't stretch out the issue of the extent of the zoning. RPL hasn't put a proposal on the table saying this is where the boundary should be, for example. My understanding of what those mapping hearings was about was really primarily about rezoning requests. And this is something quite different. The extent of the zone was notified. And RPL's evidence presented at this hearing addresses the extent of it. My submission, it would be wholly inefficient and prejudiced to QAC to defer the hearing on the extent of the zone to next year. It would give RPL an opportunity to give it a second chance to run its case and bolster its case in line with what's been presented here.
Ms. Wong, it's rather late in the day to make this submission. If this concerned QAC when receiving the notice of hearing in the Section 42A report, it was appropriate to file a memorandum at that time to give everyone warning that QAC was concerned about that point.
Well, QAC did not see it as a tool that we didn't consider. It was a possible outcome. It was only council for units opening on Monday that it became apparent that that was a possibility. Mm. So we didn't, and because it wasn't addressed in the Section 42 report, when, as I say, there's a table that goes through the individual submission points, it's not in there. So we had no notice. And if it had been, absolutely, I would have filed something.
Well, the question, of course, is whether the individual submission points are all submission points relative to RPL's submission. I don't know. I don't know how they've been divided up, but I cannot, at this point, having heard RPL yesterday, to say in that presumably presented their case on the basis of what the council presented. I cannot say, well, sorry, we're going to deal with all of that at this point without giving them the opportunity to address it all in full.
I don't think RPL did present their case on the basis of the submission the council made on Monday, because RPL pre-lodged its evidence in legal submissions before it had seen the council's legal submission. And as I say, that was in after the Section 42A report had been notified, and it didn't make any reference to this issue being referred, and RPL didn't make any reference to it either. In my submission, everyone has to say that in this hearing on the basis that RPL's submission is being dealt with at this hearing, and to do so, to take any other approach would be artificial, to try and extract or to pull apart RPL's submission and divide it up in that way. I just can't do that. I think it deals with the issues in the round, and they're very much related to one another. I can't see what you would be dealing with differently, what additional issues you're going to be dealing with, or what additional evidence you're going to have at a later hearing. It would, as I say, with my submission, very much prejudice to QAC to do that. And
you're not prejudiced at all. Well, the opportunity to be heard in June of 2017. I'm not making any directions that we will not hear any parts of the RPL submission that have not been set down for this hearing to back them to be dealt with now. It's as simple as that. And that reinforces it.
And for my submission, applying the same logic, you would be deferring QAC submission on the Wanaka Airport zoning. Because that is looking to create a new zone. Boundaries of that zone aren't notified. It's a rezoning hearing. Same thing applies. What would you be dealing with for the Wanaka zoning?
Wanaka one is a different circumstance because that arose from QAC seeking a particular set of rules in the rural zone to apply specifically to the airport.
I don't think it is different.
Well,
once you look at it. And
we're not going to spend the rest of the morning talking to our I'm not pulling those submissions forward. So we can move on.
Well, I feel like I can about that, and I say a bit more in my written submission. But I understand the position, and I don't think I can do that at this hearing. So then I get on to the
seat. And make some practical noise control.
RPL's submission that the effects of the proposed extension cannot be assessed because the extent and location of the development is not known. Of course, that ties back into my submission I've just made about dividing these things up in the way that it's proposed. So again, RPL's argument on effects is very similar to the argument at random that you were trying to assist the international hearing. As explained by Mr. Kyle at that hearing and in legal submissions at hearing also, the airport land is limited in its extent and significant areas are and will continue to be required to facilitate aviation activities, meaning that the potential for the establishment of commercial and other activities that is not central to the operation of the airport is low. Mr. Kyle also explained at the designation hearing that the activities sought to be enabled within the, or supposed to be enabled within the airport zone will most likely be located within the terminal complex or in proximity to it. And I've already noted that in any case, in terms of effects, any development will be subject to a range of development standards relating to built form, urban design and so forth. And any other activity will require a restrictive discretionary consent, and the matters of control are fairly broad. And so in my submission, RPL's argument that the significance of the proposed extension of the zone and its potential effects cannot be assessed is overstated.
So just so I better understand that part of your submission, are you actually saying then that the broader range of activities will only occur in close proximity to the location of the existing terminal building and not elsewhere on the site? What is it you're actually saying?
Miss Carl will address you on this further. That's where they're most likely to occur, given
or most likely to occur? That's, you know, I'm asking for certainty. Can you give me any certainty or not? Should we still be dealing with most likely to occur, maybe, possibly? Is that the case you're
Well, I don't think I can give you certainty on that because it's the agents and the market and the process to some extent.
So we don't know that yet, do we? There's a master plan in place.
That's correct. But as the evidence of the trial data, the designation experience is that the runway is people's most significant assets.
I understand all that.
So I think that most likely is pretty strong, most likely that will occur within proximity to the terminal.
Doesn't this point about doubt about what's actually proposed make some sense in terms of what Mr. Sargent was talking about?
Well, in my submission, no. And because if you look at, as I say, and Mr. Kyle will address this, if you look at the airport and what's on the ground, there's that airside infrastructure that isn't going anywhere. And so you, most of the key place where you can undertake other development, landside development, around the terminal. There are a couple of little pockets of land.
So what's going to be happening on the couple of little pockets?
Well, that's an unknown, right? But and Mr. Kyle will address this, and they're pretty small, and in terms of this proliferation of adverse effects, it's just not going to happen. The airport isn't going to go and do stopping people on the runway or within the runway clearance areas. And when you take those out of the mix, there's not much left over at all.
Well, that's sort of what sort of troubles me about this. I understand all of that, but I just don't understand why there's such a lack of certainty. You know, you say that there's not much left over and they're not going to be doing this, that and the other thing, but...
QAG's evidence and also the notified objective policy is that flexibility is required to for the operation of the modern airport, and this zone, that's what this zone seeks to provide.
So,
Mr. Kyle has the other people giving you a map which shows the extent of land we're talking about here, and that might assist you with understanding the submission I'm making.
But doesn't the flexibility that you talk about require a total lack of certainty?
Well, I think
flexibility can include some indication of a likely range of uses that an area might be put to, or a likely area where uses may be located. And an element of certainty can be created that way while retaining flexibility. It seems to me that your submission is that QAC should be able, within the entire landholding, to do what it wishes.
Subject to the parameters provided in the zone. There are some parameters, and I think that's about what those are in terms of the seats and assessments and so forth. And I'm saying that in reality, given what's already on the ground, this issue is actually I then address the economic and traffic assessments and the effects, which RPR do those assessments, the assessments of some kind of evaluation are are inadequate, and in my submission they're not. And I note that in this next section that Mr. Sargent himself has, paragraph 134, he acknowledges that the economic assessment is useful because it supports the overall importance of the airport to the local and regional economy and its status as national significant infrastructure. And identifies that while the direct benefit of the airport operation in monetary terms is relatively small, activity which relies on the airport is very significant in monetary terms. He also considers that overall the activities proposed to be enabled within the expanded zone take advantage of the economic opportunities provided by the airport and so will add to the overall regional economic output. He does not consider there to be any specific activity provided for within the zone which raises the potential for an oversupply situation and potentially adverse economic effects. So in my submission, rather than contradict or challenge the economic assessment, the largest evidence for RPL in fact supports it.
But again, as this paragraph 611, what's your reference? After he says what you've quoted, he goes on and he says, for that reason, I question whether a wider analysis is in order for this zone change. So what do you say to those words?
Well, I do that later in my submissions, which, and again, what he's referring to there, based on what he said previously, is evidence the wider analysis should have included the RPT and the pre-refactory zone. And as I say in my submissions, and the council has made the same submission, those zones aren't on the table, and that is by virtue of RPL's request, didn't want those zones to be addressed. So I can't have it taken as it could. I can't say you should have looked at providers of these activities in our zones, but actually we don't want our zones to review through this process. So therefore your proposal must fail, which is what it's saying. And I also,
I think that is an incorrect analysis. The zones, the two zones, the Remarkables Park zone and the Franklin Flats B zone, are not part of the review, but they are operative zones that do exist, that do allow activities, so they are part of the existing environment. Should we ignore any part of the existing environment that's not part of the PDP? Is that your submission?
No, that's not my submission.
Well, that would seem to be what you were
suggesting. We're talking about whether these activities should be provided for within those zones.
I thought Mr. Sargent's evidence was consideration of whether they were, rather than that they should be.
I addressed the adequacy of Section 32 evaluation later in my submissions, which is really related to this point, I think, and whether all alternatives need to be considered, which is RPL's position, and is tied to this point. And so there's the traffic text. I know that section that it appears, and I'm not entirely sure, but it appears that perhaps Mr. Sargent hasn't appreciated that. He says there's no control and there's no justification for it. There's no control on any transportation that is actually said or something said in the airport zone. And that's not correct. Activities within the airport terminal are proposed to be exempted from the district-wide transportation activities. All other activities, so district-wide provisions will apply. So there will be control on transport matters in the zone. And the justification and rationale for exempting those activities in the terminal is that they're not of themselves stress generators, either at the airport and in the terminal because they're catching a flight. They're not coming. That they're not generating those activities, they aren't generating those in their own right. And transportation section is of course being reduced past stage two. And so, if need be, these issues can be addressed at that time.
So is it your submission that in evaluating the adequacy of the sign, we should ignore the potential transport effects that may be created by the activities allowed in the zone, because the transportation chapter is in stage two. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I'm responding to Mrs. Darden's evidence, which was that there are no controls on transportation that is in the zone, and I'm saying that's not correct. There are controls, and the No-5 chapter refers to the Chapter 14, and that those controls apply, and CRDC sought removal of that because it's been reviewed.
In answering our questions yesterday, Mr. Sargent, as I understood his evidence, stated his concerns in large part were that there was a lack of evaluation on the roading network, the transport effects of the activities that would be enabled by the zone elsewhere, well, as well as at the terminal point, elsewhere on the airport's land. Are we entitled to consider that?
Those effects. Well, there is a transportation assessment which does consider those effects and says they are going to be negligible because those activities must be ancillary related to the airport operations, so they're not. That means that you're not going to be close to the destination activities and such. What I take that to mean, and so are not going to be significant traffic generators in your own right. So there is
evidence
on that, and it's the only
direct
evidence that you have.
If we look at the activities that presently occur within the operative zone, which are airport related, in large part, those that are not part of QAC's operations are rental car companies and campervan rental companies, aren't they?
Yes, I believe so.
Wouldn't they have transport effects on the roading network if located elsewhere on QAC's land?
So they may do, but those effects, there is transportation that's chapter 5 that would apply to those activities.
That's not the point. The transportation chapter deals with rules applying to activities when they're established. A consideration of traffic and transport effects is a different matter. The question I put to you earlier was that your submission that we should not be doing that because the transportation chapter deals with them. And you said we should be.
That
transportation chapter deals with them.
That's not my submission. My submission related to Mr. Sargent's statement and his evidence that there are no controls on transportation matters in this zone. And I said that's not correct.
Just to briefly round out the point, Mr. Sargent in his evidence actually says, my view is that in the absence of any knowledge as to the composition, the location and access provisions of any future activities within the zone, I consider that drawing any conclusion on transport-related effects is not possible.
Well, Mr. Sargent isn't a transport engineer, and he was a traffic provided by a traffic engineer.
He's a planner, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. And he's just saying, as planners do, there isn't enough information here for me or anybody else to make an assessment. That's the point I'm drawing to your attention.
Well, yes, he does say that.
And can he do that as a planner?
Well, yes, he can do that as a planner. And Mr. Powell's evidence that he'll give to you today, perhaps he might assist you with evaluating that
statement and just the amount of weight you put on it, and that again is tied to where these activities are actually going to most likely take place. And I suppose, you know, what's the land area we're actually, the developable land area we're actually talking about.
Sure. If you know now, Mr. Carl's going to tell us now about where these things are going to happen, why wasn't that put out on the table much earlier?
Well, it's responding to RPL.
So these issues would have been at play at submission time?
Well, RPL's submission is a pre-launch submission. If you look at it, it's quite different to, and not particularly clear.
Is there a reason why the information hasn't been made available earlier about what's happening there on the site?
Well, the point of the zone is to provide one of the points, purpose of the zone is to provide flexibility.
My question was, is there a reason why the information that you now have wasn't made available earlier? So, for example, RPL could look at it and Mr. Sargent wouldn't be trying to scrabble around to try and understand what's going on. He'd have something to respond to.
Well, there was the zone was notified as part of the proposed plan, as the council's proposal, and included with that were obviously a section 32 evaluation, an economic assessment, a transportation assessment, and a noise assessment. So, That was the proposal on the table. QAC made a submission on that. QAC has filed its evidence in accordance with the direct timeframe.
So that, for me, that's not answering my question, but I'll leave it there.
In the next section, I address the impact on the Queenstown Centre, and that's in relation to a decision made by RPL and with reference to TC50. And RPL's submission, first submission, really that enabling the range of activities on the exceeded land. Will potentially have an adverse effect on the town centre. And if I just pause, most of labour the point, but going back to this issue about hearing the RPL's submission and the extent of the zoning, RPL's submission relates solely to the extent to the new area of the airport with East Dynia. The issue is about the extent of the zoning. That's what the whole submission is about. So,
it's not just about that. It's also about the additional activities allowed by the zone.
Within the extended area?
No, within the entire area.
If you read the synopsis of the submission, that is not what RPL is talking about, other than visitor accommodation. I'll read it for you, paragraph
2.5. No, I'm familiar. Visitor accommodation is the very point of my statement. So
well, then perhaps we should just be dealing with visitor accommodation in this hearing, but that's not what RPL does. They deal with everything else. And so, in my submission, if we're going to defer this, the whole thing should have been deferred to the planning hearing. And by not doing that, RPL has been given the opportunity to present its case twice and potentially bolster it. So without wishing to label that more, back to the PC50 and the effect on the town centre. I've set out in detail in my submissions what PC50 was about and the conclusions reached in that decision, and that was in the council decision which was upheld on the field of the environment court.
That's different from
the appeal. I agree. It was. Yeah, so there was a decision. It wasn't a consent order, there was a decision. So the court accepted the council's reason. So I assume you're familiar with TC50 and Mr. Kyle, as the order of that change can take you through it in detail. detail if you require. But in short, the determination was that the Queenstown Town Centre and the Frankton area was considered in a complementary and a not a competition. And that the reason that the PC50 was required to deal with the shortage of land in the town, zone land in the town centre, as opposed to dealing with potential competition fractions, that's the PC50 ended up. So, in my submission, there's nothing in what an RPL's argument in this regard.
But I was just intrigued by that because you're relying on PC50 for that proposition that the status quo is. The town centre and Frankton serve different needs, different purposes. But of course, things will change, won't they? When the airport comes along and it does whatever it's going to do.
Well, in my submission, there's...
So how can you rely on PC50 as a proposition that there won't be these impacts that RPL might be concerned
with? Well, I think the statements in PC50 are still relevant, and that it was accepted in PC50 that there's a huge development capacity out of Frankton, and it's fully realised that it may have, you know, has potentially could rise to effect on the town centre, but actually they're two different things.
But my point is that the airport's, if I can call it, proposal wasn't at all considered, wasn't live in PC50.
No, that's correct, but in my submission, the reasoning still applies, but in any case, in my submission, what is being proposed for the airport zone is not going to be in competition because there's this requirement that the activities have to support and be ancillary to the airport operation. So you provide it's a different proposition that's provided for a different market, I guess, so they're not competing. So it's even more distinct from this other Frankton land, which could potentially have effect on this.
Thank you.
The adequacy of Section 32 evaluation, RPL has said that that's flawed because it fails to consider all other reasonable alternatives.
I think you can go through that quite quickly.
Yes, the 9.72 analysis.
We essentially have to do the same Section 72 analysis in any event.
Yes, what I say is that the Act doesn't require formally other reasonable alternatives to be considered, but other reasonably practical options for achieving the objectives must be considered, and that level of detail in that assessment must correspond to the significance of the proposal. And I just also note that the Wellsmart case, which was the PC50 case, in that case the court said that you could potentially satisfy Section 32 by comparing the proposal with the opposite provision. So you could just comparing the proposal with one other proposal might actually satisfy the assessment of other reasonably practical options required in Section 32. And in this case, there was an assessment of three alternatives. So in my submission, the Section 32 evaluation was adequate in terms of the requirements of the Act, and is also consistent with the approach taken by the Council and other Section 32 evaluations for Section 32 evaluations for other zones. So then I get on to the monitoring report, and I'll probably go over that quite quickly as well.
It isn't the major issue at Wanaka, is this issue of the floor space, which is really a matter of fact, which we need to ascertain the facts on that in reality.
That is the primary issue there. But what I say about that is that Mr. Heath's evidence doesn't in any way support McCulloch's recommendation. He has clarified now that he thinks there should be a tenancy cap on non-airport related activities, but there doesn't need to be one on airport related activities. And of course
with non-airport related activities will be non-compliant activities in the zone in any case. So the tenancy cap is unnecessary in terms of what he's doing. Ms. Holland says, well, she acknowledges she interpreted it as a heat incorrectly when recommending the tenancy cap rule, but stands by it nonetheless. But does there's no evidence, there's no usual basis for it, no evidence of it actually affects on the town centre. And I say you need to think about retail distribution effects here, and that's quite a high threshold, and certainly has been made out in this case. And I would say, based on the residual evidence, that it's actually unworkable, and the limits proposed would include any further growth and development at Wanaka Airport, because the limit is used up by existing activities, so you can't have anything more out there. So there's been no assessment as to, or justification as to why the figures of 100 and 1,000 have been picked, and as it turns out, they don't provide for what's already on the ground at 1-3-4.
Now, while we're talking about that, we propose to visit Wanaka Airport on Monday morning. I am assuming that from the public areas we can see what we need to. If there are areas that we want to let Ms. Prendergast know who we can contact.
Yes. So that's really it, I think, I can leave you to read my submissions on that. I'd say there's no evidential basis for what Ms. Holden is proposing. There's no evidence that it's required, that there was going to be a potential effect by not restricting these activities. Again, one group is constrained by grant holdings, which is what actually can happen out there. The Solomon's recommendations don't provide for what's on the ground, let alone any growth and development. So then the final issue is the local shopping centre zone, and I just read you the scope there, and that is in relation to the mechanical ventilation requirements in that chapter in relation to aircraft airport noise. Dr. Charles has...
I can stop you at that point. Okay. Your real concern is the One Hanson Road site, isn't it? Or is it more than that?
I think Mr. Carl is probably
the reason I ask is before you arrived yesterday morning, I advised Ms. Lovise that we had concluded from her evidence that the activities likely to occur at One Hanson Road may not be consistent with the local shopping centre zone provisions, and consequently we were going to defer all consideration of that land to the mapping hearings next year, and I'll be issuing a notice on that in the next day or two.
I suspect that, thank you, and certainly QAC is interested in that, but I think that QAC is interested in probably more broad than that, just because...
The rest of it is built already, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but it could be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. And so it's about having appropriate controls in place for anything.
Yes.
So
these submissions apply to the existing as well as the extended.
Yes, that's right. All I say is pretty straightforward is that Dr. Charles has scoped wrong and there is scope to... QAC has released that view that noise sensitive activities be required to be built to include mechanical ventilation in accordance with amended Table 5 of Chapter 36. Yes, which is the one where you have a lot of evidence about in the Chapter 36 hearing as to why it should be amended. And he said, well, yeah, I agree that's a good idea, but I don't think there's scope to do so. That's the point of QAC submission. He thinks there is a scope because the scope issue was in the town centre table.
Yeah.
But I say, well, QAC submission clearly seeks the airport. Well, you'll see.
Well, that's
the
pretty straightforward. It's self-charged, which is kind of a bit confusing. So I won't read my conclusion because I've taken up far too much time already. And unless you have any further questions, I will call Ms. Trevor.
I just wanted to talk to you about this visitor accommodation in 2 days and 3 days. It's the case you're presenting, this is a question, is it the case you're presenting that you're relying upon Mr. Day's expert evidence in relation to a 2 day stay coupled with noise treatment? In loose language, that's appropriate. Is that the case you're presenting?
Relying on, yes, light and also the no permission of natural space.
So
relying on Mr. Day's evidence,
right.
That's QAC from a commercial perspective and for other reasons.
Yeah, so there isn't...
3 days.
I'll be talking to Mr. Day about this as well, but I just wanted to confirm then the case isn't presented on the basis that there is expert noise evidence to present that supports a 3 day or longer stay.
Well, Dr. Charles, Ms. Day would support that for Dr. Charles. QAC is respectful of Ms. Day's evidence, but is seeking, because I've heard slightly from the defense in relation to the duration of stay, and would like one more day.
Yeah, and I'm asking a question in that context then. Mr. Day seems to be quite clear in his evidence about 2 days. Okay, so I'm saying, where then is the expert noise evidence your case relies on to provide 3 days?
Well, we accept that QAC's expert noise witness
He doesn't go that far, does he?
That is acknowledged. But obviously, Dr. Charles, who's in this also before, so that needs to be a restriction at all. And he doesn't think there needs to be a restriction on short stay accommodation in terms of the duration of stay.
Okay.
So you have that evidence in front of you as well. No doubt, and I suspect you will have questions from Mr. Day about that. And ultimately, noise is obviously a critical issue in this case. But there are other issues to consider here as well. Bearing in mind the parameters of the QAC is prepared to live with and accept it, wholly appropriate for those other issues. And also, as I added in the rest of my legal submissions, the fact that people are going to will anticipate aircraft noise when staying in an airport hotel on the airport. So that's a distinguishing feature from other noise
installations. Okay. And final question from me. Your paragraph 93, this is where you're looking at the New Zealand standards. And you say there the standard does not expressly reference visitor accommodation. Okay, it does however refer to new residential. And are you saying visitor accommodation just isn't covered by the standard? What are you saying?
Mr. Day can probably address you on that.
But it's your submission.
Yes, based on the standard, which will give you today. So that's my submission very much based on the standard. The standard recommends that any new residential dwellings, schools, hospitals, or other noise-sensitive uses. So it falls into this other noise-sensitive uses, potentially. And the district plan contains the definition of SAM, which is based on the standard, but goes further than it and lists out other noise-sensitive uses, really, as by this district, and visitor accommodation is included. So the standard itself doesn't expressly identify visitor accommodation, is my point, whereas Mr. Hunt is suggesting that it does, but it actually doesn't.
But would you agree that NZS 6805 is a relevant matter and provides, if you like, cover when considering visitor accommodation?
What do you mean provides cover?
Well, it's a relevant matter to take into account, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, the QAC wholeheartedly accepts that.
Yeah. So whether or not it's expressly referenced really doesn't matter much at all, does it?
Well, no. What I'm responding to here is RPL's argument that and that QAC's position taken here to the visitor accommodation has been consistent with the position that's taken in previous proceedings, which have been based on at the NZ standards, and it was going to be on the standards. And responding directly to Hunt's evidence to be suggesting that visitor accommodation is stated as a standard as being a noise-sensitive activity, or it's not. But yes, Mr. Daly has said that he sees that visitor accommodation is a noise-sensitive activity. So the evidence is that short-stay visitor accommodation, as is proposed, is a much less noise-sensitive activity than these other noise-sensitive activities referenced in the standards and we fill in the definition. And with the restrictions in place that are now being proposed, you deal with the potential adverse effects on immunity and also reverse sensitivity effects. So you're not inconsistent with the standard or with the approach taken up or the same taken previously by QAC.
Thank you.
Did
you have any questions? We will check the morning adjournment and we'll reconvene at 11:55.